You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
It's that time of the week again, folks. This is me, your host, Richard McCall, here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. And this is episode 326 of the Columbia Calling podcast. And it is part three, the final of three segments, three parts, on our Darien Gap Crossing series with the journalist, Canadian journalist, Nadia Drost, who's been kind enough to really give us a quite profound insight into what it's like to hike the Darien Gap Trail, to travel alongside migrants from far off in across the world, trying to seek a better life in the United States, to follow them up into Mexico, what happens in southern Mexico, and then at the U.S. border. It really has been an enlightening opportunity to speak to someone in the know in this situation. Of course, harrowing tales of loss, tales of theft, robbery, and worse, of course. So, yeah, I think that this has been an incredibly good three-part series. The only three-part series that we've done so far on the Columbia Calling podcast, but our numbers have been way through the roof in the last couple of weeks, so I take that as a positive. Here in Bogota, in Colombia, that we are approaching 70 days in quarantine, and this looks set to continue. I would expect the mayor of Bogota, Claudia Lopez, to break ranks with the government when the month comes to an end, but we'll see how it plays out, of course. Remarkably and extraordinary times. And of course, to all of you out there, please stay safe, stay healthy, heed the warnings, and stay at home if you can. Thank you again for listening. I will be back in the third segment, in the final segment of this show, with Nadia Drost talking about and bringing to a close this series on the Darien Gap Crossing. Thank you again. Bye-bye. And we're back. This is the final segment of the Columbia Calling podcast, episode 326. We'll be talking further to Nadia Drost, picking up exactly where we left off last week and talking about the Darien Gap, but of course, more not only about the migrants this time around, but also about travel opportunities, why you should or why you shouldn't be traveling in this area. So we'll leave it in the capable hands of Nadia Drost right now. A couple more questions, and I know I've taken up so much of your time, but I want to roll back.
No worries.
Thank you. I want to roll back because we've heard all about this journey through Central America, Mexico, the US, and the roll back to the magazine piece, because there's been a lot of interest in the Darien Gap, obviously, since you've done this and written your piece. And of course, there was an uptick in interest when Carlos contributed as well to the piece in Outside magazine some years ago. There's these upturns. And now I was contacted by a guy who runs a travel agency in Cartagena, and he's kind of got some clients in the north who now want to do it. They think it's like one of the last adventures, and I just think it's one of the most ridiculous things ever. But before we get into that and your thoughts on this as a tourism adventure, I mean, let's talk about the environment. Is there a better time to cross the Darien Gap when it's less wet? Because you're going to be wet the whole time. And as you describe it, there's no break in the canopy. You're crossing rivers 15 to 18 times, let's say, a day. The physical toll on your body, I understand. I think your feet and the boot rot that you're getting. And of course, there are, you've got photos that this is absolutely just terrifying photo of the rib cage and skulls of people who've perished along the way. So, I mean, if we, I know it's a bit more superficial, not as heavyweight as talking about the migrants, but let's get back to that. I mean, what do you think about this? As let's say a tourist from North America wants to do this as a, as a trip with some friends?
Well, I mean, I think the Darien Gap is many things. I think that the Darien Gap has developed a kind of mythology around it as this, you know, dangerous lair and full of farmed groups, and, you know, dangerous and poisoned animals. And yeah, there is all of that. But I think that, you know, the route that we took, sure, had certain physical risks that I think are inherent in any kind of trip that anyone would take through the Darien Gap. But the risk of physical assault, of sexual assault, really, you know, skyrocketed because bandits know that that's the route that migrants take. I know that, you know, in the past, you know, anybody who's been interested in the Darien Gap will know that, you know, for over a decade, people who are not migrants, who are adventurers or perhaps botanists, interested scientists, who try to go into the Darien Gap without getting the kind of required local permissions, often from armed groups, they're simply, you know, they don't manage to make that crossing. They're not allowed to. And if they try, there can be, you know, harsh consequences. But I think we have to remember that the Darien Gap is huge. And we obviously wanted to cross where the migrants were crossing. That fluctuates depending on a lot of different factors. So one of them is definitely environmental. So, you know, maybe a river floods. And so the path that follows that river is, you know, is wiped out. So that route is no longer available. In other moments, it's because of the control of drug trafficking routes. So, you know, I know that Carlos, for example, when he's crossed the Darien Gap before, there have been times where the migrant route was kind of more through the center of the Darien Gap. And, you know, drug trafficking groups determined that it was no longer convenient to have a migration route overlap with drug routes, and so basically blocked the migratory route, and it had to displace somewhere else. So the migration route kind of, you know, it pops up and then retreats depending on this kind of, you know, a combination of both security factors and environmental factors. But I think that adventurers aren't going to be, you know, they have to take into account environmental factors and security factors, but not the same ones as that are, you know, involved in a migration route. And I think that there probably are safer ways to cross the Darien Gap. I would just question, is crossing it necessary? Like, I guess in the mind of an adventurer, you know, like maybe it's the difference between, like, do you walk halfway up Mount Kilimanjaro or, you know, to the peak? But in essence, I mean, you're just walking through jungle for days and days and days. And so, you know, what we did, I don't know, maybe it can't even be considered crossing the Darien Gap. You know, we didn't cross the whole thing. We just did the route that the migrants do. And I have heard on the Colombian side of some, you know, ecotourism ventures that that take clients into the Darien Gap area that don't conduct the actual crossing. And that seems like a great plan to me. And there was an article in The New Yorker that appeared several years ago called The State of Nature. And it was really wonderful. It profiled a you know, a small ecotourism operator who was operating in certain parts of the gap and who knew it really well. And so kind of who knew what areas they could approach and go into at certain times and which ones they couldn't. And I think that, you know, the if whoever you're going to cross the Darien Gap with or not cross, just maybe go on an adventure for a few days, they really do need to know the local groups who operate, armed groups who operate in that area, or whoever is controlling the drug trafficking routes, and get permissions. That would be my primary, if I was a tourist or adventurer, that would be my primary concern. You know, in the southern, like on the Pacific side, Pacific Colombian side of the gap, that area is really volatile right now. There's been a lot of fighting between the ELN and the Urabeños. A lot of communities have been displaced. You know, if you enter from that side, I think you've really got to be very careful. And then you also have to consider the legal armed groups then, you know, on the other side, the Panamanian border police. So we did this trip as journalists legally, in terms of we got our exit stamps from the Colombian migration authorities, and we took a boat to Panama to get an entry stamp into Panama. And then we joined up with the migrant trail. But we actually had to escape the Panamanian hamlet that we were in without the border guard noticing us. They weren't letting us go into the Darien Gap. We had to invent a whole, you know, other story about where we were going. So authorities will not let you, because they know that it's dangerous, and they don't want, you know, the last thing they want on their hands is a scandal about, you know, foreigners perishing in the Darien Gap. So that's another consideration. But I think from an adventurer's point of view, I would kind of question, well, what is it that you really want to get out of this trip? Like, if it is to see the wilderness, and I mean, it is sublime wilderness in the Darien Gap. I have, you know, it, as you know, and you've traveled throughout Colombia, I've seen a lot of jungle in Colombia. Yes. And this really was, it was the most beautiful jungle I've ever seen in my life. It was so pristine. If that's what you want to see, I don't think that you need to cross the Darien Gap to see that. I think there's ways to safely and, you know, in support of community ecotourism, take day trips, or maybe a trip of, you know, two or three nights from the Colombian side or from the Panamanian side. You know, I think the Panamanian side is probably a lot safer than the Colombian side. So I don't think that there is, you know, I don't know how important it is to adventurers to be able to kind of claim this stake of, you know, I've crossed the Darien Gap. If that's the case, well then, yeah, it's going to be complicated. But if you want to get that sense of being in complete wilderness, and potentially coming across wildlife and feeling very, very small amongst enormous ceiba trees, you don't have to cross the Darien Gap to do that.
That was wonderful, and so interesting and important to hear. And again, I'll refer to episode 303. Daniel Eggington from Birmingham in the UK was going to try in December the Pacific side, and the Colombian border police were having none of it, and they put him on a boat north. And I am absolutely relieved, because it would have been, he may have got out, but he wanted to do it alone and everything else. And I just don't think he had it in his mind how dangerous it was. And in 303, when I had him on the show, People have reported back to me, said, we listened to that show and it's excellent. And but it's also you finding 100 or 150 ways of trying to tell him, don't do it. So, but this is the final thing, and I'm going to let you go because it's been fantastic. It's been phenomenal. But what I loved is when you came out, and I think you were in the hamlet of 100 people or so, and the hamlet is overrun by the migrants, and there must be 400 migrants in there, so they're completely overrun. Mm-hmm. They think you're right. Syrian, and because you're white and blonde hair, fair eyes, they think you're Syrian. But you address this in the piece that they are open. You know, this is a hamlet. They know their role, and they are just open to everyone. It seems they're much more tolerant. Could you just share a little bit about this?
Sure. So, I was very curious about what the kind of local attitude would be of these Panamanian hamlets that have, by no option of their own, they have just inevitably, because of their geographic location, turned into these unofficial reception centers, essentially for migrants, simply because they're the first, they're the first village or hamlet that migrants come across as they're coming out of the gap. And those communities do change because, as I mentioned, the routes that migrants take, they change over the years. And when we said, when we were planning this trip, we expected that we would actually arrive in a hamlet called Canan Membrillo. We had heard that's where, most of the migrants were arriving. But by the time that we did the trip, it had actually changed, and most of them were arriving in a hamlet called Bajo Chiquito, which is where a shop owner thought that I was Syrian. And this hamlet, they've got about 500 permanent inhabitants. It's an Embera village, and at any given time, there's the same number of migrants staying there overnight. And when the flow of migrants has really kind of surged, they've even had as many as like 1,000 or 1,500 migrants staying in this village overnight. I was very surprised that most of the locals who I spoke with really tolerated the migrants and felt sympathetic towards their plight. And the reason that I was surprised is because this hamlet, and like so many in that region, they're impoverished. They have very little infrastructure to support the migrants. They don't have running water for themselves.
Yeah.
There's a real hygiene problem. Everybody's going to the bathroom in the bushes or in the river. Everybody's showering in the river. Migrants drink water from the river. So I could see how it would be very easy to kind of resent migrants for exacerbating what was already, not a great hygiene situation. But the migrants do contribute economically to this place. So, they pay locals to sleep on their floors. And for however long it takes them to get out of there, I mean, it's really cheap, $1 a night just to get a patch of floor, but it's something. There's one restaurant in town, and it's fascinating. On the wooden panels, the clapboard of this restaurant, migrants over the years have etched in their names, their countries of origin. You can see that people from India, from Yemen, from Somalia, from Bangladesh, they've frequented this restaurant, and the family who owns it, they've learned how to not only say certain foods in different languages, but have even learned how to prepare them. So they've learned that that, okay, you know, Africans, they like their eggs this way or they don't like them this way. And they've really tried to be accommodating. I asked myself, okay, why beyond the economic reasons might this town be so accommodating? Because obviously not everybody is going to benefit from the presence of migrants arriving there. And my suspicion is that it's quite an impactful experience to see people coming off of this trail. I mean, you can sit in the little town square. It's just a basketball court, essentially. And you can tell who is coming off the trail and who came off yesterday because they literally come in stumbling. A lot of them come in wet. A lot of them come in without wearing anything. And a lot of them are very, very sick. They line up at the Xenofront, the border police outpost, and they hold out their baseball caps to receive a ration of rice. You know, they don't get a bag of rice. They get rice poured into whatever vessel they can produce. They are not given kitchens. So it's up to them to, you know, find a pot, make a fire, make a pot of rice, unless they go to the one restaurant in town. So I think that it's very hard to ignore the really desperate condition that they're stumbling into town in. And also one of the, you know, kind of more horrific and visually impactful scenes that I am certain so many locals have seen is that you don't have to walk very far out of town to see dead bodies. So, you know, within a day and a half's walk from Bajo Chiquito, you know, up into the jungle, that's kind of where the highest concentration of bodies is. And so I think that, you know, they know the jungle. That's where they live. They know how difficult it is. And they know that the people who are walking through are not nearly as prepared as them. This is not their home. They don't know how to survive in a jungle. They don't have machetes. They don't have hunting rifles. So I think that they probably understand, they can understand what an incredibly tough journey it is. And they also visually see, the consequences. They see the bodies who have perished or maybe who, you know, float in the river downstream.
Nadia, thank you. There's absolutely nothing I can say that will, you know, thank you enough and say my appreciation for this. It's been just so revealing. We've gone obviously so much further than you were able to go, I think, in the article. Well, you've got a limited amount of space, although it was long piece. But
yeah, absolutely.
This has been really
well. Thank you for giving me the opportunity, because as you mentioned, I mean, there was so much that I didn't cover in the article in terms of, you know, geographic distance, but also, you know, I wrote about just one group of people and their journey. And there was kind of a lot behind the scenes that happened. And that I didn't write in first person. So it didn't really have a place in the piece. So it's great to be able to share that. Thank you and your listeners.
No, I am so very grateful for this, and you know, to put the reality of the migrant struggle and to grapple with the issues, of course. And there's nothing, of course. I mean, there's nothing that I can possibly relate to that comes anywhere close. And I'm not going to be. You are my hero for having done it and written this piece. And thank you.
Well, think about, you know, I did this trip with an immense amount of support, and it is incredible to think that every year, I mean, last year there were 24,000 migrants who did this trip without that level of support, many of them carrying babies, breastfeeding on the way, many of them injured, many of them children. And so I think, you know, what they went through, makes it a Herculean accomplishment and journey that they did.
Thank you again. So we'll be looking out, of course, for the PBS series. You can find Nadia's writing, Nadia Drost, in all sorts of places. I mean, you're really, really very incredibly accomplished. The Globe and Mail, of course, PBS NewsHour. She's a filmmaker. Closing this off, do you remember the first time we ever spoke? You called my hotel in Montpos and you were going to come up for Semana Santa.
Oh, that's right. I thought it, the first time we met was in a hotel in Bogota
with Stephanie Nolan.
Stephanie Nolan.
No, we spoke on the phone.
We'll
have to leave it there. And that has the end of our three-part series with Nadia Drost, who's given us an amazing amount of her time and really some quite incredible insights and experiences, anecdotes, and, of course, thoughts to consider when we think about the Darien Gap and the plight of the people who make their way through this, trying to find a better life there in the United States. I think it's been an incredible three-part series. And, of course, the number counts of downloads really, they back this claim up. We've surpassed 11,600 listeners in just over 30 days, or just under 30 days in the US, as over 1,500 in the Canada, around that in Australia as well, and 2,500 in the UK, 4,000 in Colombia, and over 1,000 in Germany too. So thank you so much to all of you out there listening and supporting us on Patreon, on buymeacoffee.com. It's very important for the Columbia Calling podcast to continue going. I just want to say thank you again. Do keep an eye out for Nadia Drost's work. And of course, it will be on PBS before long. Everything's been pushed back because of the coronavirus. But the documentary series will be out on PBS for you to see. So you'll be able to actually see the experience that they lived on the several-day trek up through the Darien Gap. Quite incredible. Well, of course, we'll be back next week. We'll actually be back with Rainbow Nelson, a journalist who's based in Cartagena. He's been living there since 1996. And we're going to talk about the post-COVID COVID-19 tourism world, how we can turn back the clock and perhaps improve tourism, let's say, on the other side. So thank you again for listening. I've been Richard McCall. This has been Columbia Calling. Check out our website, columbiacalling.co, book and everything else. And you can, get in touch with me and suggest anyone that you might want to hear interviewed on this show. Thank you again. Bye-bye.